Hey, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. This is Willem Vanderhorst, your host for the show. I'm very excited. It's the 4th of July, so to everybody in the United States of America, happy America Day, happy National Day, happy 4th of July. If you're listening to this, I mean, I'm recording on the 4th of July. You'll probably be listening at some other point, but go figure. And good morning, afternoon, evening, night, whatever time of day or night it is for you. Very excited to be back. It's only been a week since the last time I published. Normally, I would tell you to expect a gap of a couple of weeks between published episodes, but I really wanted to get this episode out. It was a lot of fun. I had this great recording with my friends Alfie Denon and Alex Harrison Darcy, who are based in London, UK, and they currently have a Kickstarter on for a board game that they've spent the last couple of years designing called Evil Corp. Evil Corp is a board game of evil billionaires. So it's a battle for tech supremacy against fellow billionaire CEOs. Win the fight, own the future, and save the world. I'm just reading from the subtitle of the Kickstarter. The Kickstarter is successfully funded. So if you participate, and I wildly obviously encourage you to do so, because I've been following the game. I've been very excited about it the last couple of years. So we really get into this in the conversation. But just for brevity's sake for the introduction, Alfie is a product strategy. He's the head of product strategy, I believe, for digital marketing and product agency called Possible in London. I've actually worked at Possible, but in Singapore. I had a short stint for a few months over there, so we didn't work at the same time in the same place. But coming from there, he's had a lot of experience in tech, online strategy, marketing, products. He's owned a couple of startups and a lot of different businesses. He's worked for the UK government. Alex has also managed a couple of businesses, software engineer, consultant. He's worked a long time ago for PlayStation Europe, and which he talks about during the show. And both gamers. So we talk about tabletop role-playing games, about board games, about what their inspiration for this project was, how did it all start, what the process over the last couple of years leading up to this Kickstarter was. We talk about a bunch of stuff, including science fiction and dystopia, and, you know, billionaire startup CEOs who are there to save the world and what's going on with that kind of stuff in the world. We really get into under the skin of like where the game comes from, how do they create it, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a few days to go for the Kickstarter. Obviously, I really urge you to go onto Kickstarter and dial up Evil Corp, type up Evil Corp and back the game. They're into getting stretch modes through at the moment. And it's a fun game. It's really designed so that it's easy to handle and get into for anybody. It's not designed specifically for, you know, heavy board gamers. There's a little bit of everything in it, but we really get into all of this in the conversation. So without further ado, here are Alfie and Alex for this awesome conversation about Evil Corp, the board game. Hey, Alfie and Alex, welcome to the show.
Hey, Willem.
Hiya.
Hi, this is exciting to have you. You're in the middle of a Kickstarter right now. We're recording while your Kickstarter is going on, and this is going to be published before the end. So we're going to be talking a lot about Evil Corp, the game you've designed. But to start with, I'd love to hear, and I think everybody listening would love to hear, well, let's just start at the beginning and figure out who are you?
I'm from somewhere between South Africa and London, I guess.
That sounds like a good story to start with already.
That would be roughly Sudan, I think. or Tanzania.
And you see, clearly we're already setting up who the cartographer in the room is. I was born in Joburg, and my mother's British, my dad's American, and then basically moved back here in 95. And wow, that's a boring
story. So that would have made you how old approximately?
Oh, I'm 42 now.
You think that's a boring story? I'm about to trump that.
But you're asking us to do the math between that and 95 right now, or?
Well, I mean, as long as we're not doing it in the Sudan, I think it's fine.
You moved back there, and that was London at the time, or?
Yeah, London. So my mum, I moved there to go and live with my dad, basically, and go to school. And then coming back in 95, I mean, it was kind of just pre-Blair, and living in Highbury was a completely different type of London than it is now. Like, you know,
for the people who don't know, how was that a neighborhood that was different from now? Or?
Yeah, yeah. So basically Upper Street, which is now like massively gentrified, was essentially just a series of shuttered shops with squats on them. And London was still like sort of open and free and I don't know.
So you just wanted to be basically back in Joburg.
Living in the shanty towns.
It is very gentrified. It wasn't that gentrified.
It wasn't then.
Of London was pretty ungentrified in that period.
And now here we are right now in Haggerston in a building called Ability Plaza in perhaps the most gentrified part of East London.
No, it's not gentrified yet, but it's on its way.
It is, isn't it?
To be honest, you can't be inside the, I think, hitting the edge of zone two is there's literally nowhere that isn't being gentrified. And then soon it'll be the edge of zone three. And the only people who'll be able to afford to come in and work on these salaries will be robots. So it'll be fine.
And that's sort of, it's not exactly a segue into Evil Corp, but things like automation are part of the whole subtext of the game, really.
Yeah. How about you, Alex?
Sure. Alfie was saying about how boring his story was. I couldn't be more English. I was born here, both parents here. Came to London early 90s. They're both, you know, entirely northern family.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty dull. Grew up in a...
Okay.
Well, actually, I mean, of course, because he's so English, he underplays it all. But his parents were fascinating.
No, they're not.
Well, your dad's pretty fascinating. I like him.
I get to decide if my dad's fascinating or not.
I think every single person meeting him might get to decide that. But what do you find fascinating about him?
I like the fact that like he's an incredible session musician, and then him and his wife as teachers basically built a life where they got to not only be session musicians but also teachers. And Alex had one of those lives which are probably not going to be very common from now on, which is really comfortable, beautiful house, really nice sort of group of family friends.
Yeah, you're describing the nice version of it. It's pretty tedious from my perspective.
You know, indeed.
It's one of those things that looks nice from the outside.
Yeah, quite sentimental kind of thing.
And sensing you're going, I wish I had that.
I did. And also, Alex studied artificial intelligence. What was it? BA? To degree level, which is, it's kind of funny, right?
Because, yeah, see, please.
Okay. Because now, actually, that stuff is possible now. But at the time, I guess it was all just sort of conjecture, right?
Because you're getting somewhere. But we knew that the computational problem was going to be in the way for the next 20 years. And it turned out to be the case.
Mm.
And now we're solving the computational problem. But the other thing we didn't know was that I'm not sure how relevant this is. The need for the training sets. Training sets actually solved a lot of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, IBM was doing the whole, domain learning thing. Yeah. You'd have to just train the crap out of one thing. And was it called?
So, Alex, you were studying artificial intelligence from a computer coding standpoint. That's, I mean, I guess that's where it starts, right? I mean, I don't know much about it, so it might be a silly question.
Well, the degree was AI. It was basically not computer science, but a lot of half computer science, half philosophy, half psychology, and half working out how to make four halves a whole.
Yes.
I'm sure that's a joke that some people are going to get.
That's
one's for you guys there.
For people who understand halves.
What did you study, Alfie?
I didn't actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I finished school and... I basically thought that I was just going to be a professional skateboarder, so I was banking on that, and then I broke my knee.
You're not doing the knee injury excuse. That's like everybody who claims they were going to be a great footballer. I was going to be a great footballer.
Well, I wasn't.
I tried out for teams, but then I broke my knee. And
I was AmPro, right? I was on the way, but I was definitely more of a Wastrel kid. But I was always entrepreneurial. Like my first company wasn't a company, but I hired like 5 kids around the yacht mall in Durban to clean the bottom of boats. And then I just took 50% of their earnings, and then that was my business, you know? I guess I've always just entrepreneurial already.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And skateboarding, where did that start?
Oh, I was like 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I still skateboard.
That's growing up in that sunny environment. You don't get skateboarding is never particularly big in Britain because of the rain.
Yeah. It's a different sport here because rain.
most sports are a different sport in Britain because rape. Table tennis is about the only one that is comparable.
Well, it's kind of like cricket. Like, I don't think that you can call cricket a sport because you break for oranges. Like, that's just brunch.
No. There are very few sports that take 5 days.
A lot of cricket fans might disagree with you, I think. But
take a month to play a game. The test is 5 sets of 5 days. That's a lot of cricket.
But to be fair, it's
obviously originated in Britain because most other countries get over with it in a couple of days. But we're not sure what the weather's going to be like. So
indeed,
you have to take a
5-day sojourn. Yeah.
That's why they shortened it to just a couple of hours into baseball here in the States.
Let's not pay attention to the reduced attention span of people. And also
it's just lazy cricket, isn't it?
Yeah, well, no, it's hurried cricket. It's hurried cricket indeed, in order to get as much into an hour and a half.
Well, it's basically you have to fit a bunch of adverts in the middle of it and you couldn't sell the ad space otherwise.
To be fair, 2020 is pretty exciting.
Uh-huh.
For cricket.
That's true, because we have come back.
Yeah,
actually, Britain played the best game of cricket they've played ever like 2 days ago.
Did they?
I'm only barely paying attention to the world.
I did not know about that. All right, how about gaming? When you were growing up, teens, studying, did you play like board games, role-playing games, anything like that, or video games? Or
I was a big games nut, but not really board games, more tabletop role-play. And of course, computer games.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was always like computer games from the SNES up, and mostly RPGs like Final Fantasy, and then tabletop, probably in my early 20s, because my sister used to be the, she was new comics manager at Forbidden Planet, and so she really helped me get into comics, get into gaming.
Really build up your nerd side.
Build up the nerd side.
Put that cool skateboard away.
I couldn't skateboard anymore. Nerd. Exactly. It's like nerd up, brah. But I think neither Alex nor I have ever really been into board games. It was more that I think when we hit on the idea of the game, it sort of had to be a board game.
Well, I designed a lot of role-playing games, mainly for fun, mainly because that getting a good role-playing game mechanics right is very hard to do.
The
first game I ever designed as a role-playing game, it took an hour to resolve 30 seconds of combat. I realized at that point that while it was incredibly accurate, it was lacking in a certain value of entertainment and brevity.
He's come a long way since then.
But that kind of thinking about how systems, especially to do with simulation systems, you know, all game design is about balancing rational simulation with the entertainment value of it not being too accurate. In the same way, it's like any kind of narrative form. It's not about representing the reality, because otherwise it would be very boring. It's about distilling down the excitement of what it is you're trying to get across as a story. So kind of game design is from the same perspective.
I think it's kind of amazing, don't you, that actually, like board games, they cross some kind of weird inflection point, right? They're hip. Yeah, they're hip now. And I think it is
Hang
because...
Hang on, is the word hip hip?
Is it hip? I don't know what hip is anymore.
What's Willem, you must be...
I think
I'm
it's
not
cool.
Sure.
It's cool.
I think hip is not particularly hip. I think it's going to be doing a comeback because old worlds come back, but I'm not sure it's there yet.
Well, I like the way we're trying to define how hip is.
How about rad? Is rad still in? Or if you're the skateboarder, Alfie, you would know that.
Rad died with skateboarding.
Okay.
Gleaming the cube, brah.
Let's say popular.
Zeitgeisty. Yeah. And I think the reason is because actually the narrative form as it is in board games and card games as they've been popularized by things like Cards Against Humanity, is because more people who aren't necessarily from board games get to do that.
I think that's the social angle coming back of it. You know, the thing I find interesting is that there a huge rise in board game and tabletop role game play in response to network gaming on consoles, which is kind of surprising because the whole point is it's meant to deliver that. But in fact, network gaming is one of the most tediously antisocial things you can do.
How so?
Because if you can get a group together and you play with a regular group, then it's exactly the same as being in a room. You build up a kind of dynamic, you build up your own language, your own internal kind of joke system. But most online game playing isn't like that. It's wildly combative. Combative, what's the word I'm looking
for? It's combative, it is.
But against 2 billion other people. So the sense of pleasure you get out of it is non-existent.
I think you've hit on something like really core, which is that like, okay, if you, and this is going to tangent a little bit, but if you compare Facebook and Snapchat, right? So Snapchat is essentially a whole bunch of features and mechanisms which are designed.
Sorry, just to stop you for a second. Considering a lot of people or some people listening might not know anything about how Snapchat works. So can you just like give us a rundown at the same time you're explaining?
With Snapchat, essentially what you're doing is you're updating moment to moment, but you're ultimately trying to reach people who are already close to you, whether it's through an image, whether through it's something that's funny or moments that are happening.
Because basically all the people you're contacting are in your phone contacts in the first place. They have to be able to follow each other, right?
And the difference is that ultimately on Facebook, what you're doing is you're competing for likes and attention. And they are exactly opposite to one another. And I think it's a little bit similar to what you're talking about with network gaming, which is that ultimately it's combative, it's competitive, but board games, even when competitive, sort of a social in a way that's connecting, you know, and they are a really kind of interesting alternative to it, which is probably part of why they're zeitgeisty.
Yeah, but I think the competitive angle to it, it's the kind of quality of the competition. You can a good game where you're competing with each other, but at the end of it, you're all laughing. That's fun. A game where you're competing with each other, and at the end of it, one of you is wanting to be killed by the others is not a great thing. So yeah, the objective of a game in which everybody's laughing at the end is kind of what you want. And whilst certain good kind of party play games, console games such as Destiny is a terrible game in many respects, but certain games like that, you play with a bunch of friends, and at the end of it, you feel good about it, or you play cooperatively with a bunch of friends. Whereas if you go and play something like Call of Duty, I mean, I would rather saw a leg off than play online Call of Duty. You're just surrounded by tossers. Mm. 12-year-olds being teabagged by 12-year-olds with no sense of value. You know. I don't want to get into it. I'm already getting angry.
Yes, we can hear that.
Well, I was reminded of this wonderful story that Alex likes to tell about about a tabletop that he was playing. Right. And this guy had rolled.
Let me.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was playing a tabletop game, it's Deadlands, with friends. And
which is basically a Western role-playing game with zombies, pretty much.
Yeah, it's basically Western zombie. Yeah, that's pretty accurate. I was going to say it's not exactly accurate, but you know who cares. It's not like
you're welcome to rectify in detail if you want.
Let him do that.
It took me half an hour to think of the right word, so let's not bother. but yeah, so the episode was we were playing with a group of people, most of them quite good fun, but one person took it very seriously, and they seriously wanted to be basically. Your Clint Eastwood, you know, man with no name, ultra cool. So they spent ages investing on this gunslinger character. And then immediately in the very first session on top of a train, facing off a huge Wendigo in this horrible situation, had immediately drawn a gun, rolled a critical fail and just thrown it off the tracks. And this was a gun which was incredibly totemic to the character that they'd built up. And so we all laughed and he didn't. So then immediately the next opportunity he goes to draw his other gun, which was also, you know, his two shooting kind of guy, and rolled another critical fail and immediately threw the other gun off the train going at high speed. So just thrown both of his guns. And we fell off the table laughing essentially, and immediately came up with the name the Gunslinger to describe him. And he hated it and he never came back. I mean, we had a great time, but it's like if you have a game where you have that kind of tension, you know, sorry, we had a great time at his expense. Actually, I've just realized that makes us bastards.
No, but the main thing is that...
The way you told the story don't come out as a nice person.
I'm on the wrong side of the story.
Well, this is the age of being on the wrong side of the story. But I think the really cool thing about that story is that it's not about that game. It's about the fact that the story that you get to tell is the thing that people remember.
Yes.
And that's what games are about.
Which is kind of... Actually, that's Alfie's doing his job properly because that's a perfect segue to what the kind of design of the game experience is all about. Because it's kind of...
Wait, what game? Our game?
Our game.
Evil Corp.
Evil Corp.
Our game, Evil Corp. Currently on Kickstarter.
Currently on Kickstarter.
Funded in six days.
I think you're at 124% funded right now, aren't you?
Okay, at least someone's checking.
We got very drunk on Thursday to celebrate and as a consequence couldn't remember to check anything. So we're getting back on it. Maybe cut that bit. It sounds very unprofessional. But yeah, so the underlying kind of point about the game design is...
I could totally hear that, like, the whole foundation of this interview is professionalism.
It's our cornerstone.
To be honest, professionalism is about doing a good job, not necessarily presenting yourself well. I always find that, you know, that leads to the need to wear a tie, and I've never been that good at that.
But there is also a kind of little segue there, which is that when we launched, I was really happy with failing because I knew that we had done everything that we could. The work itself was just great, you know, and so everything that we'd done all we could, you know, and so if we failed, then it would be on the basis of other people, and that's fine.
That's because Alfie's a happy-go-lucky kind of guy. I was absolutely dreading every moment of it, and I was, having never done a Kickstarter before, I only had the two stories in mind, the one where it was a total disaster and the one where it was an unmitigated success, and we're kind of on the success side but not unmitigated, so the first day or so was just going like, I don't understand what's happening. Why are we neither failing or running away? This is weird. Why do I feel this way?
But to come back to your point about what we designed, it was for people who really want to have stories.
But the whole point, we sat down with kind of a list of fairly strong demands for what we wanted the game to deliver.
So where did it start, the idea of even just designing a game in the first place together? And by the way, I wanted to put in as well, like just slight segue, that we all know each other. And through James Whatley, who was in the show before, but like we know each other from days back in London, and we hung out a few times at drinks events, and I think James's birthday or something.
Yeah, that Twitter sphere.
It was back when the internet was actually still open, and it wasn't just dominated.
Oh my God, you're just so depressing. And it's like, I know. Free and young, and the sky was always blue and it never rained.
Stay on theme.
Yeah.
But it's true, man. Like, you know,
kids were so
better than me at skateboarding. Yeah. The internet was free then because Facebook wasn't around.
Yes, it was.
Only just 2007,
2004,
right?
2004.
Four.
Okay, right. But what had just come out was Twitter, because we're all early adopters, and all of us met through that kind of network of kind of bloggers moving into the Twitter arena. All of those, what was the name of those meetups that
Twitter? There was London Bloggers Meetup. There was
Twestival.
Twestival.
The Twestival. I remember that. Yeah, first Twestival. That was big.
I don't remember that. I got very drunk.
That was the beginning of We Are Social.
That's right. And We Are Social went gangbusters. Yeah. So I think when we all met, for me at least, it was characterized by a slightly more kind of rosy future after the first dot-com crash or bubble burst. Then it still seemed that things were like more possible.
Well, it was in the sudden growth spurt after the rise of HTML5 and the open source movement, which all had kind of, I mean, it was... We were going to rebuild this without the bubble, which has gone relatively well for the last, let's say, 12 years. But it's going to happen again. You know, I think that time.
Were you guys both working around startups at the time, or?
Yeah, I had a startup called Moblog, which was basically there weren't really any mobile blogging platforms around. There was Text America, and then they went under. There was a couple of small things.
This is the era. We're talking about just the arrival of the iPhone. About then,
just that before, sound, so just like before, 2004, 2003 is when I had Moblog.
2007. So yeah,
exactly.
The Nokia ecosystem.
Yeah, our core IP was actually a mail parser, which would remove all of the extraneous advertising that all of the networks would put into MMS and email messages without your permission. So that was our kind of core thing: was that we could extract just the subject line and just the body and publish that with an image to the web.
How about you, Alex?
I'd just come out of a huge rolling contract with PlayStation and was doing agency mobile stuff. Again, we were in mobile. A friend of mine who I'd worked with before had decided he wanted to start a business and invited me to kind of come on the front end of it. I did most of the front end for PlayStation Europe at that time.
Okay.
So it's kind of little. It was all kind of new agency in the mobile sphere. It all kind of went interesting. And then decided to move back to the US at short notice and left me in the lurch, which is a pain in the ass.
It's just basically a common theme, I think.
It is a bit of a common theme. But yeah, so I mean, that's when I kind of met you guys, all of those kind of various elements. I remember I remember clearly meeting Alfie because within 10 minutes we were having a huge argument about dark AI philosophy in the most weirdest way. And other people would say,
what is dark AI? Or the argument was dark, sorry.
A bit wanky but dystopic futures, yes, essentially. Absolutely. And I think, you know, bonded over things like Bruce Sterling and Ian M. Banks and what the future is really going to look like.
Ian M. Banks.
Did I say Ian Banks?
No, you said Ian M. Banks.
Yes, Ian M. Banks. Exactly.
Yeah. But they are the same.
Who is the same person?
Well, was. In the same way that Stephen King is also Richard What's-His-Face.
Bachman.
Thank
you. But nobody confuses those guys.
No. But I think, you know, it's just about where we are actually is in that moment of Bruce Sterling's distractions. Or, you know, definitely we're not in cyberpunk world.
I think we're in heavy weather, actually.
Are we?
Yeah, we're not yet.
Is that a Raft reference? No, we're not at Holy Fire yet. But Holy Fire is coming.
Well, that's an interesting point, actually, because the conversation you were having back then, if that was a couple of years before or around the same time, dystopia became a really big topic for young adult novels and, you know, big serializations and big movie adaptations of the Hunger Games type.
Yeah, but they were ripping off the older kind of generation of serious dystopic stuff.
Where do you think that all came from, of it being so popular?
Well, I think for a new generation, yes, I guess. That I was being a bit wanky in that statement of kind of being, oh, yeah, but yes, but no. I think that the subject of dystopias is something we can talk endlessly about, especially given the current times or end times. I'm not entirely sure.
The thing. The end times really did start about, you could argue them for the 60s with the Cold War, right? And the nuclear threat. But actually...
I'm with, what's his face? How the world... Oh, what's his name? Francis Wien's argument on this one. He said late 80s.
Oh, yeah.
Mid to late 80s was when it all began to go to this. Oh, sorry. Was it mid to late? Early 80s.
Uh-huh.
And saw the kind of rise of all sorts of kind of interesting changes in the political dynamic, changes in how all that kind of stuff. And it does actually coincide with the rise of the cyberpunk literary movement as well.
Who was the person you referred to? I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name. I'll have to check and put on the show notes.
I may have to check. I think it's Francis Wien. He wrote a book called How Mumbo Jumbo Took Over the World.
Oh, that fucking book.
Yeah,
amazing.
That's a great book. He posits that it was a change in the political dynamic, the rise of Reagan and Thatcher in the West.
It was essentially the moment as the Exxon Valdez crisis. It was the moment that we realized that the commercial underpinnings were essentially about to invade our governments, we're successfully doing it.
By the way, we say we did that. We were all about five when this
I recall very clearly examining the Exxon Valdez crisis, but going, "This will change the world."
I don't know. I had a pretty political family, you know.
But you were five. You were three.
Well, hey, look. The first concert I went to, I was five, and it was Paul Simon's Graceland, and we were tear gassed out because it was apartheid South Africa. And so, at least, you know, well,
okay. There's more to that.
There is more to that story, indeed.
It sounds like an interesting story too. So, we've got the dystopia side of things, which I think is one side of some of the thematic of Evil Corp, and then the other side, which is businesses out to save the world, and how businesses or startups need to somehow seem to need to have an extremely, I don't know, life saving, societal saving purpose to them.
Do you remember, like, sort of 2005, 2006, all of the iconography around startups were that very bubbly, round, all of the kind of blended corners, everything was very soft and approachable, all the logos were really kind of soft. And that's the kind of feeling that startups have to have when they have the sort of scale that they have, you know, now. And I mean, looking at Mark Zuckerberg addressing Congress was just this completely fucking surreal moment.
Actually,
To see him in a suit.
To see him or grappling with the kind of the world that not necessarily the world is created, but how it's being handled by other kind of parts of the world. You know, the thing that I was kind of tickling in that case is that it's kind of easy to argue, and I'm not going to say bad, but it's definitely easy to argue that Facebook is a cause of a huge amount of social change that is not necessarily for the good. I remember us having this conversation 10 years ago. What's that Clay Sharkey book about? Clay Sharkey, is it? That's
Clay Sharkey.
Here comes everyone. Here comes everybody. This great democratization of content is going to be so great. It's like, no, it's going to be shit. I remember having that conversation with you, Alfie, and going, it's going to have good bits, but you know, the problem is curation. The problem is taste.
It sort of comes back to that inherent, like, of course, they, much like Google, have changed their strapline from don't be evil to something else. You know, move fast and break things is just simply not appropriate for that exact reason, which is just that the unintended consequences of well-meaning actions are so much larger than one can anticipate.
And that really is kind of one of the underlying points of the Evil Corp idea. Is that essentially the phenomenal amount of power that we go all the way down the kind of track. So essentially the way that the internet is set up is that that if you acquire a kind of brand position lead, then you can't help but be a monopoly. And if you're going to be a monopoly, you can't help but be a billionaire. And if you're going to do it while you're 24, you can't help but be massively misinformed about the nature of the world. Particularly if you grew up in an environment in which you're talking online in forums of people who aren't talking to anyone else, and you get these vast echo chamber mentality issues that are just phenomenally full of bizarre misunderstandings about the true nature of the world. And then you end up going, well, here's how we fix that. And without anybody to necessarily stop you. And so it's kind of not, it's more to do with the kind of cautionary mentality rather than kind of like, this is bad. Because again, it could work out fine, but there doesn't seem to be any evidence to support that it ever has.
Mm.
So, you know, that's kind of the issue. The issue is to do with these hyper personalities. And also it's fun to cast them as James Bond villains. So that's what we do as well.
Because that's inherently the nuance in the game that's quite hard to communicate other than when we have conversations like this, is that, you know, we're not taking the piss out of Elon Musk. We're just pointing out that
may not be for the best.
Yeah, it's just like, of course you're not going to get it right. But the problem is that if you have only 8 months that it takes you to get the agreement of a municipality to drill these enormous holes underneath the city.
Underneath LA. Underneath San Francisco. Have they not seen A View to a Kill?
In what would otherwise take 8 years of regulatory rigor. Like, it's just not, it's asymmetrical in this way that it's bizarre.
So
I think
obviously there's a huge advantage on the kind of entrepreneurial and the technological side of being able to kind of do things very quickly. And that has its advantage, but it's a balancing act against the slowness of legislation. Legislation needs to be slow. It needs to be rational and reasoned. Actually, I got a comment about that recently. Let's not go there. It's too controversial.
Well, I mean, I think the legislation thing is so interesting because, like, for me at least, being interested in the future is that, like, we
can't... You'll grow out of that.
First of all, the reason that we have a hard time talking about climate change is because then it's really hard to actually picture it, even though we can see it pictured in front of us. And it's quite similar to looking at the sort of coming apocalypse of the impact of AI, machine learning, and automation on our very basic economies. And it's easy to point out, right? So I think I might be misquoting here, but about 36% of the US economy is essentially about truckers and all of the services that support them, right? Mm-hmm. And so what's going to happen, of course, is that Uber is going to solve that problem. Sure, it'll create jobs, but will it really, really? And what about all of the people who are running all the diners that are like along those routes? What about all of the gas stations and all of that stuff? And so I'll finish the point up very quickly, but basically
infrastructure is complicated.
Infrastructure is being ceded from municipalities to commercial interests.
And it's phenomenally more complicated than people take account for.
Yeah, it's extremely complicated.
So that's
part of the reason why we people in general, if you're not happy about a personal situation that's happening, you're looking for the simple answer and a simple answer and a simple culprit to whatever the problem is, even though the world is increasingly ridiculously complicated.
Yeah, but people are just watching Love Island.
I'm not watching Love Island.
I'm not watching Love Island. I don't know. Is that a reality show?
Should I be watching Love Island?
Just watch one episode. Yes.
No.
Is it like X on the Beach?
Don't watch it. And anyone listening, don't watch it either.
Okay. Let's go back to Evil Corp. So I'm particularly interested in a lot of the conversations I have around the podcast are like, where do creative ideas and projects come from? So how did this idea come about? Where did it start?
We were playing a tabletop game that Alex was DMing, and we were essentially like crappy superheroes in 1980s New York, and none of the big superhero teams would accept us because our fatal flaws were severe. So we all kind of ganged up.
We've already talked about the joy of talking about a game afterwards. That's not what this is
no,
about.
It's not.
But essentially the trope came up of the Evil Corp as part of the
Wayland Industries, the Tyrell Corporation.
Yeah, part of the guys talking about what they thought was happening. And I was going, as a good DM does. I'm not sure if that came across. That was a physical movement.
You just did a sort of evil laugh. Oh, I just went, a templing of the fingers.
While a lot of gamers listen to this, the DM is a dungeon master in a role-playing game, just in case you didn't know.
That's the best thing in the world. I hate playing role-playing games, but I love DMing them. It's more fun.
You're great at it.
I enjoy that very much, too.
Yeah. So the idea came up, and at some point we said, this would make a great board game. And then,
game. Yeah. I don't know that it was immediately a board game. Yeah. I think it was because it was about the world, and best representation of a world is a map.
Yeah.
Right.
The point was that we went Evil Corp. That would be a good name for a game. Mm. That would be a good game. And then, one of us started Googling and going, it must exist. And as over the course of 20 minutes went, it doesn't exist.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we've been developing the game now for 2 years. And so every couple of weeks I'll Google and just be like, has anyone made it?
We beat them.
We did. Yes. For the first time, because the first game that Alex and I tried to make was a game called The Veil, which was an AR game based on this platform, which would allow for asynchronous gameplay. As a mobile game experience. And then we spent maybe 4 months.
It was basically what much later became Pokemon Go, which by those guys.
But Google, I can't remember the name of it right now. They released a game, which was essentially, apart from the thematic, everything that we'd been making.
No, we had a couple of clever innovations.
There were some differences.
For instance, you'd be bound to your network point. Would be like the battle zone. So if you were in,
which is pure Pokemon Go.
That's exactly the kind of thing.
But the point there is just like we've worked together on a number of things actually,
and none of them have
worked. None of them have worked apart from this one.
Ever worked.
What do you think is the difference with this one?
We got it done relatively quickly, and we stuck to it.
It was about sticking to it. You know, I don't know. For me, at least, I've got a list of ideas, right? And then the ones that recapitulate themselves in your mind and keep on gathering steam are the ones that end up being made. Mm-hmm. And this one just, it sort of wrote itself. I mean, obviously, Alex and I fight a lot.
Yeah, we fight a lot.
But it really wrote itself. Like, we knew very early on pretty much what it was, and it hasn't really changed that much.
Well, there's been, we knew earlier again, because part of our exercise was, and it's like any creative thing, you kind of start with an idea, or you start with a collection of ideas, and the smart thing to do is to write down what you, most importantly, the things you don't want it to be, and then also the things you do want it to be, and then that becomes a framework inside which you can, because the most important thing is the process by which you evaluate where you're going and whether it's good or not.
And the way that we do it is essentially like, so we have world event cards, and world event cards are essentially where we bring all of our parody and satire in. And there are things like,
that's from the, a weird world thing.
So like a -1 billion impact on the world economy in a given area in the game would be characterized by a piece of copy that says fear of terrorism. It's just a step to the right. And the reason that it's plus one is because actually if people are afraid, then they stay in more and they order more from Amazon. You know, and so
it's plus one for you, not for the world.
Yes,
it's
as a business.
One for you as a business.
And so our creative approach is essentially when we were creating all of this content, we were just like, all right, whoever is funnier wins, essentially.
So that'll be me then.
Well, no swearing.
Depending on the audience. So like going from the top, how does the game work? What is it?
Let's see. So the objective is you're one of a collection of tech CEO billionaires. You've made your billions. Now it's time to save the world. I'm basically reading off taglines that we've been working on for the last 6 months. So you've made your billions. It's time to save the world. And you do that by you know, three phases. The first is to acquire your hot startup, the technology basis by which you're going to build your prototype, and which is your phase two card. Once you have your prototype in place, you're ready to build your killer app. And your killer app is a distribution method of your secret evil plan.
It's a vector. So for example, the Utopian, right? So his whole thing is to a cleaner world for everyone. And his whole plan is that the best way to solve climate change is to use
a pathogen
to kill 99% of the human species. Highly utilitarian.
It's a demand problem.
It's a supply and demand problem, exactly. And so it's that little...
Let's be clear, that is actually also the plot to Kingsman.
Indeed.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. So the way that we design the game is that it's essentially a piece of cinema. So phase one, and we made a short film with Mike Sizemore and others, which essentially is phase one, mm-hmm. where an agent infiltrates a startup and subverts their staff and gets in. And that's a 6-minute short film. And the next phase is that they go and they cripple the prototype.
That's not really But right? I know you've moved on too quickly. But essentially, once you've got those three cards in your technology sorted out, then you're ready to launch your secret evil plan. But that can still be stopped. So in the game dynamic, that's the point where you get to the last act, where everything's all kicking off, and that's where kind of we've gone into. So the way you can be stopped is by the other players stopping you, mainly so that they can run their plan. And they do it by that, you know, they send an agent in that turns each of those phases around, which is where.
Yeah, we've had also a little bit of pushback from the gaming community in the sense that our end game is essentially predicated on chance to a degree, in that it's a die roll, but it is your hand management which allows you to get agents and to get reroll cards, which then offset that and balance out a bit more. But the pushback that we've had is, oh, wow, we spent so much time tactically building these assets. We have all this money that we've saved up, but they're all sort of useless for us. But the point actually in the game is that once you've launched your evil plan, is that it is extremely hard to defeat that person. And that's pretty much our whole construction.
But there are two sides to that. One is that we do have an objective, but it's, I think, we've still got time to kind of think about that. We've got some ideas about how to address that. Because the last thing we want to do is deliver a game which disappoints. It's like a movie that's great until the final act. Nobody wants that.
Yeah.
That's a Rotten Tomatoes failure right there.
39%.
39%.
We wouldn't be happy.
We don't want that.
No. But the point here is simply that, you know, the agent dies and the CEO releases that killer app,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's our whole point. And for me, like, my favorite board game is War on Terror, and by Terror Ball Games, of course, because they do like a.
That's the worst pun.
It's great, isn't it? Yeah. And the point.
I have it as well.
What a great game. Because.
Yeah, it's a great game.
The reason I love it so much is that the minute that anyone turns terrorist, the game becomes essentially unwinnable for an empire. Because whilst you're still getting all your oil revenues, the terrorists can cross borders without any cost. They can launch dirty bombs. They can nuke
you. Wow, that's really deep. And we've learned something. Wow.
Oh, wow. This sounds like the Kickstarter video we didn't do.
That's
why I like it. And in fact, it's sort of, for me at least, that's kind of the point of our endgame, which is that, like, it's not going to go well for anyone.
Yeah.
So in the style of the game, I'm assuming, from the point earlier, Alex, when you were talking about the kinds of game where, like, somebody's excluded from it early and they're not having fun, or other people are having fun at their expense, versus we're all having fun and we're all laughing about what we're doing to each other in the game. And I'm suspecting you're looking for, or the game's aiming for, the latter.
Yeah, absolutely. If anyone's not having fun, it's not working.
Yeah.
And how did you look at that, and how did you design or look at the game so that everybody would be having fun throughout?
One of the core things is we didn't want to reward people who are great min-max tactical thinkers. We wanted to reward people who could come do stuff, think a bit more creatively around the cards that they had in their hand. So it does reward min-max strategic gameplay thinkers, but not as much as they would like, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
The game is more to do with developing deep tactics. The more you play it, the more you realize that there are combinations of cards that work well together, and if you get them, and when you play them, makes a huge difference. But also, that's only going to get you about 35% of the way. There is still a huge amount of chance, because as you well know, having worked in the kind of startup industry, it's not about planning. It's, you know, the planning is just so that you're in a good position when the luck comes along. So exactly. it's that kind of mentality. So the whole kind of point is that it's, I mean, I have played a game, a playtest recently where I was playing and had none of my face cards down and was losing badly. And two turns later, I won. Because you could come from the end that way. So one of the points we want is that people never thought they were out of the game. You can always come back and win if you get lucky and you've played smart.
And that's the thing about the construction of the card. So when we first were designing, we had two decks, one of which was what we called Nasty Business and one of which was the phase cards, which you used to progress and win the game ultimately. And then we hit on the idea of fusing them into a multi-use card, which presented a whole bunch of design issues because architecturally, this is now this highly dense information structure, which communicates like what phase you're in, how much it costs, where it goes, the name of the company. And then on the bottom of the card, it also says how you can deploy it to slow down your enemy's progress or to bankrupt them or things like that. And so the thing about the game is that at no point do you feel that you don't have agency, because you can act out of turn in certain ways, whether it's in a response to an attack made to you or whether it's to defray or deflate someone else's progress using the cards themselves.
And also we wanted to make sure that another part that relates to that is make sure there's a lot of discovery in the game as well. So almost all the cards, obviously the logic around the phase play is self-explanatory because we have to explain it, otherwise the game doesn't make any sense. But around the kind of take that aspect that is the Nasty Business card, we deliberately are ambiguous in certain phrasing just to wait for that moment where people go, but does that mean I can? Mm. And it's like, well, does it say you can't? But no.
Yeah, we were
well,
at.
Well, then you can.
We were at a games conference in Germany called Spiel.
Yes.
107.
Oh, you went to Spiel? Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, we were. It was awesome, man. It was so good. Like,
I'm going to Gen Con in August. I'm super excited about it.
Well, we'll send you a copy of the game before. We'll send you a prototype to take with you. And what we learned there is that
Germans hate.
Germans cheating. Don't like cheating.
They don't like cheating.
And so it was.
I mean, let's just make that a massive stereotype right there.
Yes, but, right there. Yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, we needed to get at least one into the conversation. But we learned an enormous amount there. I think one of the things that I learned actually was that the board game world is actually fairly stultified. The design patterns that are used, the themes that are used, are all sort of just tropes, and they're just massively mined. And what a lot of people do on Kickstarter and often in publishing is they go, well, here's a trope that we know people like. Now let's just make a game within those constraints. Here are six mechanics and patterns that we'll use. Cool. Finish that in 2 months. Push it out. Make some money. And one of the things that some of the reviewers who have played the game and have done video reviews have kind of pointed out is that this is not a game where you play the Lord of the Manor. It's actually something which is reflective of the world.
I know that we had a lot of people kind of go, looking at the rules, they don't look like they should work, which we've seen quite a lot of, until they play it. And then they go, well, actually, this bit balances that bit, this causes this, this thing you think would happen doesn't happen because of this criteria over here.
And believe me, we were so glad to hear people say that.
We've had a lot of people kind of comment on the fact that the rules don't seem to be conventional. They don't seem to fit conventional patterns. And that, again, is also a kind of deliberate thing. So, again, I see what you know, your point about it being relatively, I don't think stultified is a diplomatic word.
No, I mean, there are some absolutely phenomenal games coming up, but I think that comes back to the earlier point around
that's the same in any publishing industry. You've got essentially people who are in it for the money, which is what everybody is anyway, so that's going to be. But people who are churning that kind of mechanism, and that's perfectly valid if it delivers entertainment.
Absolutely.
But if you want to do something more, I hate saying arty, but it's something more, that delivers more.
Well, that's the thing. There are some publishers like Stonemaier who make these beautiful games like Scythe. And I think that is the place that just through some sort of happenstance is where we arrived at. Because I think if you look at the way and the reasons that those games succeed, it's because of the focus on aesthetics. It's the focus on complicated but really revealing and rewarding mechanics. And this kind of core coherency across all of the different touch points in the game experience. And I guess my only point there, talking about stultified, you know, games and stuff, it's just that there are loads of amazing games out there. And it's because people who weren't previously in board games have got a platform to be creators in this way. And that is fairly new. And that's Kickstarter. And that's, you know, where all of the innovative games actually happen. You know.
Yes. How did it? How did you prepare for the Kickstarter? And
I was looking for a word, but shoddily would be the best word. We put a lot of time and effort into thinking about it, and an insufficient amount of time and effort into actually doing it. A lot of stuff kind of happened late, but we'd kind of set a time which we couldn't really move because it's all, you know, there are certain market. Alfie's coming from a background of more kind of centric around delivering products in the real world, as I'm much more kind of confined to the digital world, in which case when it's ready, you release it and people get it. Whereas in the any kind of product that is tangible takes time to distribute. So, you know, you've got all of those extra
things. We wanted to deliver it for Christmas.
Yeah. We wanted it for Christmas. We wanted to catch certain other criteria. So we kind of went, yeah, that'll be fine. And then we went on holiday and got drunk and did various things. And then went, oh my God, that's like 3 weeks away.
No, I think, I mean, what we basically did was we made a bunch of prototypes. We sent them out to reviewers to preview the game. We bought some advertising on BoardGameGeek, a few other little bits and pieces. We started talking to people in the board game communities on Facebook.
Did a lot of research and listened to it all and then ignored it when it came to new stuff and then went back and paid attention.
Oh, no, yeah, that's probably the right way to do things. But I think we kind of got lucky in that way. We didn't make terrible mistakes that were undoable. So that's lucky because I think a lot of people do.
I think getting drunk when we made the target was probably a terrible mistake we shouldn't have done.
Oh, I'm still suffering.
I'm still suffering.
Yeah, exactly. It's because we're old.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been a super, super fun experience in a number of ways. I mean, Willem, you know that like I've done loads of projects which have hit zeitgeisty kind of moments. And I think the way that I felt when we hit that target and had the sort of response that we had quite early was just the same sort of feeling I've had when I've done something that I care about and it had a good reception. And that feeling is just, yes. You know, it's great.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's great.
That's very, very exciting. I mean, I was super excited to look at the preview for the Kickstarter. Even following for the last couple of years, seeing your Instagram and the playtesting, seeing the cards come to life, seeing you, I think you were like 3D printing stuff at some point. I remember for like a couple of photos going through. And the short film, The Agent, is very cool. Like, that's very exciting.
Yeah, we got so lucky. I mean, because Mike Sizemore, did you meet him back in the day?
I think I have.
Yeah.
I think I have.
So Mike basically...
I know the name. I mean, I follow him on Twitter.
Yes. Anyway, so he had a really wonderful success with something called Slingers, which was a sort of sizzle film.
It wasn't really a success. No. Yeah, it's been a bit of a...
From his career point of view, it's what triggered him out. So he went to LA.
A useful failure.
Yes, exactly. Like all of ours.
That's a single uselessness failure. That's my... anyway, sorry.
So Mike ended up in LA doing sort of script doctoring. I think he worked for Bad Robot. And I think of him as a sort of English Joss Whedon. Do you know what I mean? He's got a really similar tonal quality. So we got super lucky because he's back in London and his sort of broad crew of Andrew Sykes and Stephen Kilpatrick and then actresses like Haruka Abe and actors like Akie Kotabe were just around and they were able to come in and work with us. Also, Russell Buckley, our friend from Kindred Capital, was kind enough to lend us his building for the weekend. So we got to have these sort of five floors plus a roof garden to play in as a production team. We just got so lucky, I think.
That's really cool.
It's saying you get lucky. It's one of those things where you kind of talk about how you end up in a situation where you're able to be successful. And it's like, it's not really luck. It's long-term preparation. You've lucky that we've met those people, but we've met them for years. Maintaining those relationships, being, you know, learning. It's about surrounding yourself with talented people.
Yeah, it's like
making sure you're in a group of interesting, smart people doing interesting, smart things. Yeah, you realize that
you've got really interesting friends, and that's just so wonderful, actually.
Yeah.
That's, I think, actually...
Fantastic.
In terms of, you know, what you were saying, that one of your recurring themes is how does creativity work? How do you do it? A lot of it, I think, is being in the right groups of people, finding the right groups of people, and having those conversations. And I think that a lot of people who kind of don't... are wondering how it happens. It's like, because you're not doing that. Go and find it. Go out there and find the people.
Yeah.
Find people to talk to. Share ideas.
It's collaboration. It's the only way to make anything good because you're a terrible judge of your own work, right?
Absolutely.
You know, so you have to collaborate.
Look at any movie that has been made by, that's been written, directed, and edited by the same person.
John Carpenter?
No. There are a couple of exemptions, but that's how Gigli happened, which is the one of the, and I've seen that film. It's awful. Actually, I've seen 20 minutes of that film. But no, sorry, that's an aside. But the whole point is, the secret of kind of successful art stuff is good collaboration. Anybody who's kind of a name at the top of the thing is backed up by 100 smart people who are doing smart things and having smart conversations.
Excellent. All right, we're going to start wrapping up, I think. And usually towards the end, there's a couple of things. I just want to check with the Kickstarter, with anybody that goes and visits. Obviously, it's funded now, so by now, you're sure, if you participate, you're pretty sure to get the copy of the game. And one of the things that's like more and more, well, I think it's almost necessary now, is stretch goals. Like, do you have stretch goals coming up?
We launched the first few yesterday morning.
Yeah, it's because we were very hungover.
hungover.
It was all timed deliberately. No, we got too hungover to actually do the math properly. But they launched yesterday. What day is it? Yesterday? No, Friday.
Friday
evening. Of which, by the time we actually got them out, the first one had been met. So that's already been met.
I mean, there's the basic stuff like linen finish cards and custom dyes and stuff like that. But
somebody asked about the custom dye, we haven't answered.
Well, we can skip something up, right?
I actually want to keep it a surprise.
Oh, this is an aside. Let's not go there.
You don't have to reveal anything. just say, like, you know, but keep participating in the Kickstarter. More stuff is coming up.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that I'm genuinely excited about. Obviously, things like the Billionaires Club edition with anodized metal pieces and stuff, that's great. But the stretch goals that I'm excited about and the ones I really hope we get to do are essentially the sequel to The Agent and the final film, which would complete the project, which would be a final film. So what we...
Actually, mine are the ones I'm excited about are the ones before that, which are the three new rule sets.
Oh, yeah. I hate writing rules, though.
No, I don't like... I like designing the rules. They're like writing them down. It's horrible.
Well, writing is not easy, right?
No, we found that like writing rules is kind of harder than making
the
game.
It's the hardest thing.
It's super hard.
The whole thing that we've done, writing clear, concise rules that aren't weirdly patronizing and make sense is phenomenally hard.
Really, I learned a lot about how to structure things for people in that sense, and not being a writer, really.
How much time did we argue about whether you should say that the colors of the pieces are important?
Weeks.
Because it's obvious, but at the same time,
it's not.
It's like,
so the ones that I'm super excited about are the stretch goal for the comic, a 24-page comic illustrated by Lee Carter from Rebellion 2018 Judge Dredd. And his Judge Dredd is just so on point. It's like the perfect. It's so an extension of the mid-80s Dredd that's just amazing. And written by Mike Sizemore, who's currently writing Tales of Science Fiction from John Carpenter, which is an amazing comic. So I'm super excited if we get to do the comic. And that's achievable. It's achievable in a number of ways, either with a publisher attached or as a self-published piece, a writer-creator piece. And then if we really go gangbusters, then we will make the final movie, which is essentially, it's the Kingsman moment. It's the infiltration of the headquarters, secret evil lair. Hopefully someone will lend us their
if we're going to get that much,
their white cat.
We're not going to film it in a paper.
The shark tank.
Yeah, exactly. The shark tank, exactly. Yeah. Maybe the founder of Pornhub. I think he's got a shark tank in his house.
You had to go there, didn't you? You had to go to Pornhub.
Dude, we needed a couple of stereotypes and a porn reference. Okay, we got it. So those are the two that I'm super excited about.
I think that the other rule sets, because Alfie keeps going, we don't need them. I'm like, I think they'll be good fun. But the first one is a collaborative version where it's all against either somebody. We haven't decided whether it's somebody who plays or somebody who doesn't, who plays a philanthropist.
It's the philanthropist expansion.
And the second is a two-player special version, which we're currently calling Proxy Fight.
We should point out that our design collaborator, Michal Ozorowski, he came up with the philanthropist because he's actually, he might be like a really...
The thing is, he's the most committed board game player of all of us.
Exactly.
Our design guy.
And he's very, very funny. And he's very sweet, actually. You'll hate to hear that, but he is. And he came up with the idea of the philanthropist, which, of course, we had no idea how to make mechanically work. And sort of still
don't. We made a start on it.
But at the same time, it was like, the philanthropist.
And the last one, which these haven't been announced anyway, but the last rule set will be a solo playset, so some kind of solitaire version.
Cool.
And that's about it. And there are other bits in there, but we're deliberately, for the humor value, keeping them low on the down low. Again, that's excellent. Not a hip thing to say, is it?
No, it's rad. It is rad. Okay. We're just not young enough.
It's totally cool. Well, actually, talking about cool, so I usually finish it's still the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. I finish with these cool down questions. Something related to ice cream. So we have six characters that are the CEO characters of Evil Corp. What do you think are some of the favorite ice cream flavors of those characters?
Pistachio.
For who?
Yeah.
Don't just shout pistachio.
It's the only
pistachio. So what flavor? Pistachio!
Okay, look, I would say that pistachio would be the Utopian's ice cream.
Well, because it's green.
It's green, and it's also it's whole foods.
It's whole.
Yeah.
The oligarch is clearly really high quality vanilla. Not your crappy vanilla, but actually
it's your
vanilla,
Waitrose
vanilla, where you can see the vanilla,
the little beans, little dark.
I guess specks. The savant would be a thin blueberry kind of fromaggio. You know, not quite ice cream, not quite yogurt.
Yogurt. Yeah. Actually, frozen yogurt. What ice cream do you want? I'll take the frozen yogurt.
Yeah, he's a bit of a dry character, the savant. The expansionist would just be like a huge mix of everything in a chocolate base.
Yeah, but you're in Britain now, so you have to describe it using British. So there's only really chocolate, strawberry, and ice cream and vanilla in Britain. Yeah. But if your expansionist is going the full hog, it has to be Neapolitan, which is a brick of those three flavors.
You're right. So from a purely English perspective, he would be the Neapolitan.
Yeah.
Who do we have left? The technocrat. What she wants is quantum consciousness by essentially putting a neural lace into everyone. I don't know how that translates to an ice cream characteristic. Yeah.
Well, it's clearly mint.
You're so right.
It's mint. And also, I'm thinking the hot fuzz connection. Not hot fuzz. World's End.
Oh yeah.
Okay, I mean,
you're not getting.
I just don't remember the reference, but yeah.
In the World's End.
Yeah,
it's the third, the Cornetto to it.
The Cornetto
is a type of ice cream.
There it is.
Right, and it's mint because it's green, and they're aliens, and it's conformity, and it's very
nice. They live.
And there's one left. Brilliant. Who's the other one we haven't said? Technocrat, visionary,
the visionary
space.
It's red.
Strawberry.
Yeah, we already
eat. No, go be more red. What's the most red?
Some kind of space ice cream? No, do they have ice cream on the space station? Yeah,
zero G ice cream, exactly. And they already have it, don't they?
But it's got to be something you want
to
eat.
But it has to be strawberry because we're still in the UK flavor territory, right? So it would have to be strawberry for what? Elon Musk. Obviously, because, shout out to Elon Musk. He tweeted us yesterday.
No, it's about 4 days
ago. Was it 4 days ago? Yeah. That feels like yesterday.
Yeah. But I'm not sure the strawberry is good enough. What other red ice creams are there?
Raspberry sorbet.
Raspberry ripple.
A Solange, indeed.
Amarena, like cherry and cream.
Cherry.
Yeah, maraschino cherry.
Which reminds me. I like cherries.
I know, I feel like ice cream. Is that your intention?
That is exactly what I intended, yes. We talked earlier about some of the influences around dystopian sort of books. Do you have a favorite or one recommended around that kind of area? It could be sci-fi, futuristic stuff, or business stuff, anything like that.
I'm going to cut in here because I know what Alfie's is because I recommended it to him, and it's also my favorite dystopian book. Let's obviously go to the Stevenson Snow Crash.
Anathema.
The early one, Snow Crash and Diamond Age are my current favorites. But Bruce Sterling's Distraction is the, I think, the best one that Sterling's ever done.
And it's just so...
I haven't read that, so I should check it out. Snow Crash,
no one's read it. That's the thing.
You'll know Holy Fire and Heavy Weather. I presume.
Well, Holy Fire is that wonderful.
I don't know.
It's wonderful. It's basically about, you know, immortality and the impact of that actually on the human brain, ultimately, and its capacity to do so.
And society. But also, and then Heavy Weather is one that I'm pretty sure triggered the storm chaser. I think
it was very early. It was sort of, yeah.
But no, I think that was the trigger.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so.
But Distraction is just so phenomenal, and like very few people, I think, have read it.
I think it did.
And it talks to our time, actually. Yeah. It talks to our time in this way that's both serious and silly.
I cannot more strongly recommend that getting Bruce Sterling's Distraction.
Yeah,
is the best book,
and it's quite a quick read, actually.
Yeah, yeah, pretty good. I mean, obviously, Sterling's like, you know, second to, you know, pre-penultimate chapter, silly chapter, and it all follows Sterling's model and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but it's really good, and in terms of his view of a near future, particularly political US.
And I think the reason that both Alex and I are so strongly like twinned to it is because the six technology pathways in our game map quite coherently to those which are described in the game and the impact of those across the defederation of the United States and the dissolution of broad Western society. Well,
that's Snow Crash.
But it's like Snow Crashes. But
anyway, it's all they're all the same. It's all more James Bond villains. That's all we need.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. All right. Any last words? So obviously for everybody listening, check out Evil Corp on Kickstarter. Anything else you want to plug in or any words to finish with?
Yeah, but just pledge our Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Let's not muck around with it and check it out.
Just go and buy the Billionaires Club.
And pledge it.
Yeah, no, I just want to say thank you so much to Mike Sizemore, to Liam Brazier, to Michal Zorowski, and, you know, just the people who we collaborated
Chris,
with.
Sherry.
Yeah, you know, people who we would not.
We'll do that when we receive the BAFTA, buddy.
Oh, God. Let's do it. But it's a craft BAFTA. Those are the ones that count.
The
crafter. Fantastic. All right. Thank you very much for your time, guys.
Thank you, Willem.
Thanks, Willem.
All right. Well, I hope you had fun listening to the conversation. As I usually say, if you're still listening by now, you must have listened to the whole thing, so you must have been enjoyable. I would tell you, if you did enjoy the episode, please take a while to put a rating or a review on your Apple Podcast iPhone app or iPhone Podcast app or wherever you listen to your podcast. Like if there's a rating or review system, usually there's some kind of review system. It makes a huge difference allowing other people to see the show. Obviously, backing the Kickstarter, they're friends of mine and, you know, I've been like promoting the show, promoting the Kickstarter totally. And if you want to find out more episodes, obviously icecreamforeveryone.net. It's got all my content, my contact information. You can also follow me on Twitter. That's IC Willem, the letters I and C, Willem. You can tweet at me. Obviously, tweet your friends and tell your friends to listen to the show if you really enjoyed it. That makes a difference. Or just, you know, tweet at me or put a comment on the Facebook page, the Ice Cream for Everyone Facebook page. Anything that gives me some kind of feedback or whether you have some point of criticism or something to say about the show or a question or even just a word of encouragement to tell me that you're enjoying it, I promise you, makes a world of difference. Not that many people really take time to do so. And much less than the number of people listening is what I mean. Like compared to the number of people listening, there are very, very few people that get in touch. And I'm publishing now, I would say, also thanks to the few people that got in touch with me saying, hey, I enjoyed your podcast. Are you going to publish episodes again? What's going on? And that's a huge encouragement because it does take a lot of time. And I really, really enjoy doing it. But easily, you know, life goes by. There's a lot of other stuff that goes on. I'm busy with my day job, whatever else happens. And it goes on like pretty fast. So anyway, I'll stop rambling right now. I hope you had fun. I'll be back. I've been recording more episodes. I've got some exciting episodes coming up. I'll be back probably in a couple of weeks. And that's about it, folks. Have a great afternoon. Fantastic 4th of July evening, day, morning, whatever time of day or night it is for you. And see you later. Thanks. Bye.